Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
It's Saturday, April 9th, 2020.
Clear on these basic principles.
Hit it, Mike.
So is everybody clear on these basic principles? Because what we're going to do today is illustrate how they play out at different levels of analysis. We said that environmental psychology looks at people in microenvironments where they're interacting with a few other people. We look at what happens when we go to the neighborhood level or the community, societal level, or even the global level. And so we want to see how these different principles apply to individuals trying to reach equilibrium with their environment, to groups when they're interacting and you have a small group that wants to kind of stay intact and stay effective as a team, and finally for a whole population. In the Wynne Edwards article assigned for today, that's written by a population biologist who has observed a number of very interesting systems principles that work to keep equilibrium between a population size and the resources available in its habitat. How does that happen? And it's a very interesting paper because it led to a transition from sort of Darwinian checks on population size, like disease and food supply and predators and things like that, extreme temperatures, to a more internal regulatory notion that populations have these mechanisms such as territorial behavior, dominance hierarchies, that regulate their size so that they don't overstretch and overconsume the food resources in their habitat. So we're going to talk about Wynne Edwards a little bit later. So let's go through these examples. Stanley Milgram's article is very interesting. It's a paper about how people living in a large city like New York have to adapt and cope with all that stimulation, the thousands of people that they run into each day. And what are some of the ways that individuals develop coping strategies to maintain equilibrium, to not get overwhelmed by all that urban stimulation, to keep their negative entropy or their organization? So that's an example at the individual level of analysis. We're also going to talk about Argyle and Dean's study, which is very much like what the demonstration we did today, eye contact, distance, and affiliation or intimacy level. And this is an analysis of systems principles at the group level, as is the Bales and Wicker articles. Bales talks about the pendulum model of and dual leadership models of groups, and we'll say what that is. But those are ways of keeping homeostasis in groups, and it shows the differentiation in groups that we were talking about. Alan Wicker is a student of Roger Barker, who came up with the idea of behavior settings. And we'll talk about behavior setting as a kind of eco-behavioral unit and how it is that these behavior settings maintain their longevity. They, instead of dissolving, they're able to remain viable and maintain their equilibrium with their environments. And finally, the Wynne Edwards paper I was just describing, self-regulating systems in animal populations. So we're going to look at systems principles from the individual, the group, to the population level. Okay. Stimulation overload. This is the focus of Milgram's paper on what it means to live in a big city. Overload is a situation where our inputs, we're getting inputs too quickly and too numerously to process them effectively. Too many too quickly. This can happen to an air traffic controller who's trying to manage several flights coming in at the same time. And in fact, this is one of the highest burnout occupations that we know of. The people in those roles often get sick earlier. They often have to retire earlier because there's so much pressure on them, sort of keeping people alive in these airplanes, avoiding air crashes, that they often get overloaded, and that takes a toll on their health. By the same token, you can work in a very noisy, distracting environment where there's not enough separation between yourself and other people, and you experience a similar kind of overload. And sometimes people will put on earphones, they'll tune out the acoustical stimulation, although in this situation, there's still all that visual commotion as you look across the cubicles and you see what's going on in the whole office. So you can't really isolate yourself very well there to maintain equilibrium. So these are all sort of examples of where overload can set in and be a problem. So what Kao said is that they had the experimenters back here behind a one-way mirror, and they could observe whether this subject was looking at the confederate. The confederate is somebody who's hired, another student hired by the experimenters, to just continually look at the subject. So this person here, whether it's a male or female, is continually looking straight at the eyes of this other person. But what the experimenters are observing is whether that other person is looking away from the confederate working for the experimenters or right at them. And they measured how many seconds in a 3-minute interaction or conversation were spent looking directly into the eyes of the confederate. Very interesting results. What they found is that, as we said, the male subjects and female confederates and the female subjects and male confederates, on the whole, looked at each other less time. These are the number of seconds, so in 3 minutes you can go 180 seconds, and so this goes up to 140 seconds. But you can see that at the 2-foot distance, when they moved those chairs only 2 feet apart, okay, less than 60 seconds looking at each other for these groups here, the mixed gender groups. Up here, you had a little bit more eye contact, but if you compare what happens when they move those seats back further, so here the Confederate and the subject are sitting 6 feet away, here they're sitting 10 feet away, you can see this trend where as you open up the amount of space, people then look at each other more, or they look at that Confederate more. They're able to have more eye contact stimulation because they've got more room to work with. So that's what we mean by the equilibrium model of interpersonal intimacy or contact, that the space is compensating. So this is equilibrium at the small group level, where you've got a few people interacting with each other, two people in the same situation. So there you have this equilibrium principle. Here we have another illustration of equilibrium principles in group dynamics theory. Robert Bales was a famous group dynamics researcher at Harvard University, and he used to bring in experimental groups to the laboratory. He would invite people to meet for 10 weeks or so and get to know each other and keep coming to the same room each week to discuss different kinds of issues, and the group would get to know each other. And what he observed is that most groups swing back and forth between a task focus on solving some challenge that the environment poses, like a team has to, you know, find a solution to a particular problem, versus what he called a socio-emotional focus or orientation. And that means maintaining cohesion with fellow team members. And often what happens is when teams work really hard on trying to get a task done, and you've got a leader delegating work out to other people, and you've got a status hierarchy, people get kind of annoyed, they get tired, they get resentful sometimes. So you need sometimes to switch over to more of a socio-emotional orientation. And you see this a lot in sports teams, where you'll have a baseball team or football team, basketball team working really hard to win the World Series or the Super Bowl or whatever. And then when they finally get to that goal, all the tensions start coming out. People want to become free agents and go to some other team for a higher salary, or they start bad-mouthing some of the fellow players because they don't have to keep working on that task goal anymore. So at that point, the team has to shore up its cohesion, and you have when Bales talks about the dual leadership model, what happens in a lot of these groups is that a task leader emerges who is really good at exhorting people to work hard, get the job done. They don't care about delegating authority. They don't mind status hierarchies. And then you have another person who plays off of that task leader who is more of a socio-emotional leader. They crack jokes. They're more laid back. They sort of take the edge off. And these two types of leaders work in tandem in many group situations. So that's what Bales discovered through his research, that there's a kind of equilibrium process that happens in small groups, which are systems, and in order for those groups to maintain negative entropy and stay whole, they have to manage these task requirements with their socio-emotional or internal cohesion requirements. If they ignore this completely, they're going to dissolve, they're going to break up. So you have to have this kind of, he calls it the pendulum model. You have these different emphases swinging back and forth over time, and that's what we mean by systems being cyclical. You can see these patterns of interaction as they cycle over time. So that's another example of systems principles at the small group level.
There are a lot of challenges with that and a lot of difficulties with that. Keeping people's attention, honestly, judges and lawyers will tell you about the feel of a trial. You don't get the feel of the witness or the jury or what's going on unless you're together. And that is a real thing, and it is hard to do virtually. So that's been the last piece of the puzzle. We're starting them, and knock on wood, we'll be able to continue to move forward with that.
I reckon poker had as much to do with winning the West as Colt's 45 or the Prairie Schooner. As played in the Jersey Lily, it required boundless courage, an erring judgment, and soaring faith. It was more a religion than a game. The judge considered himself a past master. But then I never knew a Texan who didn't.
And once again then, Eli, you have the balance of the restrictions for safety and health, but you have to provide access to justice. And so that's where the technology component that Chloe talked about is vitally important in this whole process.
And what are the protocols in a jury trial currently? I'm envisioning the jury sitting 6 feet apart in an expanded jury box. How does that look in the court now?
Probably the best visual I would give you is think about all of the lawyer shows or the courtroom shows you see on TV or movies.
That'll be $25.
$25?
Yeah, well, I ain't winning the beer is $25.
Well, that ain't important. What is a man supposed to do?
Start losing or quit drinking.
Now hear this, sir. I hold in my possession a grant of land issued by the King of Spain for the aforementioned property.
Miss Lily knows some of them kings of Spain.
It came into my possession as payment for the Booker estate.
You don't say.
You know, spreading everybody out then creates this issue. You have people that want to watch trials, that have an interest in the trials. And in the spaces we have available, we can't accommodate that. And so we've made arrangements to have them sit perhaps in an adjoining courtroom if it is open. We have experimented with live streaming on YouTube. That creates new challenges in terms of the technology. You want to be careful that you don't create a mechanism for either interruptions to occur to record what is going on and take things out of context.
Provisions for grants of land are made in the statutes of the state. Do you have a book of law here?
Of course.
Oh, give it to me.
Here. Open for two.
Thank you.
I'll see that at the break. That's a law book, not a salt lick. Well, I'll call all that and read a $19.
Courts, I think, by nature are creatures of tradition, which I think is a good thing. Courts should be the stabilizing force in society and not react too far one way or the other as changes happen in society. That also sometimes makes us a little bit slower in coming to processes like this. So,
Here it is. Now you just start reading that, Article 48, Section F.
That's a bad law. I just repeat it.
That is outrageous.
$50, huh? My call.
How many?
got a pat hand.
So do I. I have, how do you say, the full house faces over.
Are you limiting the number of spectators, or are they just not even allowed in the courtroom? Or is it just...
If we have space, we'll let them in, but typically with the courtrooms we have in this building, one or two is about the maximum we can get in. Unfortunately, we're further compromised by the flat fact that in the courthouse that I'm sitting in Kansas City, last year in February, we had a pretty massive water line break that flooded about half of our courthouse. So two of our courtrooms that are the largest, where, Chloe, we could put some spectators in there, they've been out of commission since last February.
As you see here, Judge Roy Bean, I will not be bandied around and treated in this manner. I'm an influential man, and I have powerful friends.
So have I. I'd like you to meet one of them.
Hey.
So, Chloe, I have a question for you, because it's kind of dawning on me now that you've worked on hundreds of projects like this. Judge, you've worked on one?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's right.
You know, it's one of the things that we always tell, and oftentimes the owner will dawn on them through the process that we go through, that we've done hundreds of these. CGL has worked on hundreds of these projects. And oftentimes the owner, it might be their first jail or their first courthouse. It seems to me that Jackson County is super unique given the time frame, because it's hard to tell where to go. The old rules don't now apply. Would you agree that this is a very unique project, obviously at a very unique time?
What made it even more interesting is when we kind of started some of our discussions with the group during the programming phase, you know, what's one of the biggest crises right now facing jails is how to deal with, you know, medical and mental health.
What are you doing there in the middle of nowhere digging a hole?
My grave. When that wheel come off my wagon, I took it for a sign. This here's my dying ground.
Where are you coming from?
Lived in the mountains most of my days. I was a mountain man. Knew Jim Bridger, Kip Carson, Liver Eaton Johnson. He was a good feller when he started out. Let things get to him, though. Went bad up in the winters.
Yeah, a man'll do that. What's your name, mister?
I'm Grizzly Adams. Direct descendant of John Quincy Adams, sixth president of the United States. His blood is in me. But I went wild as a youth and run away to the mountains. Good life, free life, but cold. So cold, I'd go to the bars in winter and lie up with them in their cave. That's why I'm known as Grizzly. I cohabitated with the bars.
And that is a theme that I'm hearing more and more, which is we don't know what the future's going to look like, so we better be prepared for it. And, you know, if it's an open shell, it's an open shell, and we'll adapt around it. So.
Right. So right now we're starting the criteria development phase, which will go into spring of next year. And then, you know, we'll start really moving more into getting that, you know, design development team or whatever. However,
I'm Snake River Rufus Cryle, a long way from home.
Chris Brennan, can't stand a man that...
I'm blood kin to a Gila monster and drink my weight in wolf poison. Massacre, bloodshed, famine and drought all put meat on my bones.
I'll see that and raise your five.
Hardship and slaughter. My daily bread.
I'm considering that.
I whip full gone a longhorn cow with my hands tied. Make violent love to mountain lions. My trigger fingers are itchy. I'm set to go. Red hot.
And as the judge mentioned, we kind of did an analysis, really, of staff movements from the jail. And when we realized some of the transportation time that is being spent to take in custody from the jail to the courthouse, and we were able to narrow that in to a certain type of proceedings, like the judge mentioned. So we kind of said, well, hey, if we put them out there, you know, co-located with the facility, we're going to have some, you know, savings of money and transportation and time.
La révolte Kanak a duré plusieurs mois. La répression fut terrible. Et le peuple Kanak... meurtri au plus profond de son âme. L'insurrection a été noyée dans le sang, et les tribus rebelles décimées. Qui reconnaîtra les torts du gouvernement français? Ataï, le grand chef Kanak, piégé par un des siens, vendu aux Blancs, a été exécuté à coups de hache, et sa tête tranchée va être envoyée à Paris pour l'exposition universelle. La France me fait horreur et dégoût.
And we're back.
Nous avons enfin obtenu la grâce de ma chère Nathalie. Et j'ai dû la convaincre de rentrer en France pour se faire soigner.
And it's April 9th. Is there a better place to be than Kansas City on a Saturday night? We just listened to the former judge of the Jackson County Circuit Court, David M. Byrne. There is some questionable issues that we have with David Byrne. One is lack of transparency in his actual court record. Exactly how much time at the bench did he actually spend? He got there, and then a couple weeks later, the courthouse flooded, and they had to put thousands upon thousands of court records iced up in blocks to preserve them. He ran into some issues with KC Tenants, so I suspect it's KC Tenants will be taking the lead on the issues that Judge David M. Byrne, as far as his performance, they stopped rating his performance in 2016. And so there was another 5 years that we don't really know about. What we do know is the man, he talks to spirits. And that appears to be a conflict of interest. He claims to be an independent, yet he preached from the pulpit. From the bench, and he would say these quaint little Bible tracts to people that he had convicted to prison, which is highly unethical, highly unethical. So it's really hard when you have a strict constitutionalist to say that he's actually an independent of one political party or the other. So there's a lot being dusted under the rug about this David M. Byrne. And I certainly hope that we hear more from KC Tenants about the old judge who's hanging out here with the Pirates down here on the Carolina Beach. But let's go ahead and look at another clip. We'll kind of move on. And Carl.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, the judge sounds like one of them newfangled alt-right libertarians, Carl. He sounds like a new libertarian.
Well, now where on earth have we heard that from in Kansas?
Charlie Koch. Charles Koch, the billionaire, he said he likes to be called Chucky. Chucky Koch, the billionaire in Wichita. He's a libertarian, too.
Wow. What a coincidence. He's
independent, too, Carl.
That's right.
He's an independent.
That's right. That teenager novelist, Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, and Fountainhead. Read Fountainhead because it's shorter. It's the same. It's the same story. But after the McCarthy hearings, the everyday working class hero guy was that was over, and then all of a sudden we had the burly. Middle class guys. You know, we saw the actors, the Richard Burtons. Oliver Reed is one of my favorite, who actually went into doing horror after his career. Yeah, they're Wayne, you know. But you know, it's right before he died, he was the slave market guy in Gladiator, and he's telling us, Gladiator, bring me fortune. You know, and so it's ironic. I mean, the man was preaching talking in tongues, laying hands on people, and counting money with the other hand. Yeah, can we say that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so
how do you introduce this next clip? This is an interesting clip, too. It's got the word cult in it.
Okay, yeah, this is the CIA and the culture wars.
Oh, okay, culture wars. CIA.
Yeah, so this was picking up. You know, they were trying to create a ruling class in the United States, and as we've seen, it has fell flat on their face when all they got is people like Koch appointees in these positions. You know, so yeah, let's check see what the CIA's up to. And this is
1966. The British poet Stephen Bender.
Wait a minute. Okay. What? I'm sorry. What?
No, this is. Yeah, this is Sanders, and she's. This is like the British literary group that she's doing this report on. But yeah, she's researched the CIA and I think we had part of this clip a few weeks ago. And we were talking about Jackson Pollock and that, and then it was just, well, the elites, who else should lead the huddled masses other than the elites? And so this is kind of the other part of her story, and how they made these decisions through Alan Dulles and his good brother, quite the Protestants, Presbyterian, if we can use that word here on the show, because I don't know where Sam Brownback came from, where they found him.
He was a Methodist, and then Opus Dei caught him at the C Street House in Washington D.C., and him. He saw the light, and he joined the one true church, and
and this is the Ivanwald people, right? The what they call the family, the National Prayer Breakfast people.
Yeah, Jeff Garland wrote a big book. Called The Family.
And Charlotte was talking about how they took labor organizing methods and incorporated it to evangelize.
Yeah, right.
And that's a good book. Yeah, I'll have to look up some of Charlotte's stuff, what he has to say about the family. And
some real dirt there on Sam. Poor Sam.
Yeah, so we've been dealing with these people, you know, the old-time gospel hour on TV, and nobody ever, I don't think, everybody laughed at him. Not anymore. Yeah, anybody on the coast, east or west coast, these things, you can cut their heads off and they'll grow one back by morning.
They're independent. They're doing God's work now. All right. Are you ready for this?
Ready for this?
In the spring of 1966, the British poet Stephen Spender wrote a letter to Julius Fleischmann, patron of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and president of the Farfield Foundation. These two bodies were the publisher and financial arm, respectively, of Encounter magazine, of which Spender was co-editor. Both billed themselves as privately funded, independent organizations committed to promoting intellectual and artistic freedom. But rumors had been circulating at every literary cocktail party in London, Paris, and New York that they were not quite as free as they appeared, and Spender now wanted urgent clarification. Was it true, he asked Fleischmann, that the Congress and the Farfield Foundation were financially beholden to the American government? The allegation, he continued plaintively, was putting him in a terrible position as the editor of a magazine which emphasized its independence. After a delay of several months, during which time Spender's letter was passed from hand to hand in Washington, Spender received the reply he was hoping for. There was absolutely no truth to the rumors. Both the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the Farfield Foundation, in Fleischman's words, had never accepted any funds from any government agency. Less than a year later, the hollowness of this denial was established. Fleischman, heir to a vast gin and yeast fortune, was awash with money and had acquired the sobriquet "the Mecenas of American Culture" for his abundant largesse towards the Congress for Cultural Freedom and its multitude of offshoots. But he was also legendary for his personal meanness, "the stingiest rich man I have ever known," according to one contemporary. Spender, too, had first-hand acquaintance of Fleischman's parsimony. When his wife had borrowed a dime from Fleischman to make a telephone call in a restaurant where they were dining, she had been urged, in all seriousness, to repay it. Junkie, as he was known, didn't forget his debts. The dime was certainly Junkie's, but the money he had been dispensing with such public generosity since the early 1950s was not. It was the CIA's. Fleischman was simply a conduit, part of the famous pipeline that was pumping money to the Congress for Cultural Freedom and a reservoir of other organizations which served the U.S. government in its covert battle for ideological supremacy in the Cold War. While Spender appeared content to broadcast the denial he had received from Fleischman, others were less acquiescent. By early 1966, the California-based Ramparts magazine had already sent out journalists to truffle around in the undergrowth of the Internal Revenue Service, where the tax returns of philanthropic foundations revealed some bizarre discrepancies. There was the Hoblitzel Foundation, whose primary purpose was listed in the Directory of American Foundations as providing support to organizations within Texas, primarily in Dallas, with emphasis on aid for the handicapped. So why on earth was it funding the Italian magazine Tempo Presente, a publication of the Congress for Cultural Freedom? And what possible interest could the Miami District Fund have in the German magazine Der Monat, also published by the Congress? Ramparts was closing in on the CIA's crown jewels. For hiding behind frontmen like Julius Fleischman and dummy foundations like the Farfield, the CIA had, from its inception in 1947, alighted upon culture as one of the central theaters of the Cold War. It was the secret Mycenas, the crypto patron behind thousands of books, literally. I think its backlist runs to over 1,000 publications of books in which it was wholly or partially involved, and scores of magazines, congresses and concerts, art exhibitions and seminars. At the close of the Second World War, the United States, the one outright victor, had suddenly found itself a superpower. Needing a culture to match, it stared over the wire at Russia, which had pursued intellectual politics ever since Catherine the Great, and set about acquiring worldwide intellectual admiration and support. As the Cold War froze and ideologies divided, the U.S. government, through its intelligence and espionage arm, poured huge resources into a cultural propaganda campaign. A central feature of this campaign was to advance the claim that it didn't exist. The CIA was, in effect, acting as America's hidden Ministry of Culture. The centerpiece of the CIA's Kulturkampf, or cultural struggle, was the Congress for Cultural Freedom. Established in Berlin in the summer of 1950, the Congress was an apparently spontaneous alliance of intellectuals and artists committed to demonstrating the fallibility of the Soviet mythos and the superiority of Western democracy as a framework for cultural and philosophical inquiry. Its membership read like a who's who of the éminence grise of the period: Julian Huxley, Mircea Eliade, André Malraux, Guido Piovene, Herbert Reed, Thornton Wilder, J.P. Narayan, Hugh Trevor Roper, James T. Farrell, Raymond Aron, Igor Stravinsky, Ignazio Silone, Roberto Rossellini, Willy Brandt, Ernst Reuter, A.J. Eyre, Herbert Reed, Malcolm Muggeridge, James Burnham, Sidney Hook, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Arthur Koestler, Mary McCarthy, Diana and Lionel Trilling, Norman Thomas, Upton Sinclair, John Steinbeck, Alan Tate, Robert Penn Warren. The list is endless. It is endless. I've just realized it goes on and on. It even features Jackson Pollock, though he was probably drunk when he joined. Honorary presidents were Bertrand Russell, Benedetto Croce, John Dewey, Carl Jaspers, Salvador de Madariaga. Articles appeared in the New York Times, exposing a wide range of covert action undertaken by the dark angels of American government. As stories of attempted coups and mostly botched political assassinations poured onto the front pages, the CIA came to be characterized as a rogue elephant, crashing through the scrubland of international politics, unimpeded by any sense of accountability. Amidst these more dramatic cloak and dagger exposés came details of how the American government had looked to the cultural Brahmins of the West to lend intellectual weight to its actions. The suggestion that many intellectuals had been animated by the dictates of American policymakers rather than by independent standards of their own generated widespread disgust. The moral authority enjoyed by the intelligentsia during the height of the Cold War was now seriously undermined and frequently mocked. The consensocracy was falling apart. The center could not hold. And as it disintegrated, so the story itself became fragmented, partial, modified, sometimes egregiously, by forces on the right and indeed on the left, who wished to twist its peculiar truths to their own ends. Ironically, the circumstances, therefore, which made possible the revelations contributed to their real significance becoming obscured. As America's anti-communist campaign in Vietnam brought her to the brink of social collapse, and with subsequent scandals on the scale of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, it was hard to sustain interest or outrage in the business of Kulturkampf, which in comparison seemed to be fluff on the side. History, wrote Archibald MacLeish, is like a badly constructed concert hall with dead spots where the music can't be heard. What I've attempted to do in this book is to record those dead spots. It seems to me that it's the duty of historians to seek a different acoustic, to look for a tune other than that played by the official virtuosi of the period. Gore Vidal, that wonderful charlatan, has described recent American history as a phenomenon where the agreed-upon facts are not as numerous as professional historians like to think, obliging them to fictionalize anew those official fictions that have been agreed upon by altogether too many too interested parties, each with his own thousand days in which to set up his own misleading pyramids and obelisks that purport to tell some time. Let's not settle for the agreed-upon facts, then, but rather challenge them. This, then, in brief, is the story I've tried to piece together by wandering through the misleading pyramids and obelisks. Drawing on an extensive, highly influential network of intelligence personnel, political strategists, the corporate establishment, and the old-school ties of the Ivy League, the incipient CIA started, from 1947, to build a consortium whose double task it was to inoculate the world against the contagion of communism and to ease the passage of American foreign policy interests abroad. The result was a remarkably tight network of people who worked alongside the agency to promote an idea that the world needed a Pax Americana, a new age of enlightenment, and it would be called the American Century. The consortium which the CIA built up, consisting of what Henry Kissinger has described as an aristocracy dedicated to the service of this nation on behalf of principles beyond partisanship, was the hidden weapon in America's Cold War struggle, a weapon which, in the cultural field, had extensive fallout. Whether they liked it or not, whether they knew it or not, there were few writers, poets, artists, historians, scientists, or critics in post-war Europe, and indeed America, whose names were not in some way linked to this covert enterprise. Unchallenged, undetected for 20 years, America's spying establishment operated a sophisticated, substantially endowed cultural front in the West, for the West, in the name of freedom of expression. Defining the Cold War as a battle for men's minds, it stockpiled a vast arsenal of cultural weapons, journals, books, conferences, seminars, art exhibitions, concerts, and awards. Membership of the consortium, which managed all of these activities, included an assorted group of former radicals and leftist intellectuals whose faith in Marxism and communism had been shattered by evidence of Stalinist totalitarianism. Emerging from the pink decade of the 1930s, mourned by Arthur Koestler as an abortive revolution of the spirit, a misfired renaissance, a false dawn of history, their disillusionment was attended by a readiness to join in a new consensus, to affirm a new order which would substitute for the spent forces of the past. The tradition of radical dissenter, where intellectuals took it upon themselves to probe myths, interrogate institutional prerogative, and disturb the complacency of power, was effectively suspended in favor of supporting the American proposition. Endorsed and subsidized by powerful institutions, this non-communist group became as much a cartel in the intellectual life of the West as communism had been a few years earlier, and it included many of the same people. There came a time when apparently life lost the ability to arrange itself, says Charlie Citrine, the narrator of Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift. It had to be arranged. Intellectuals took this as their job. From, say, Machiavelli's time to our own, this arranging has been the one great, gorgeous, tantalizing, misleading, disastrous project. A man like Humboldt, inspired, shrewd, nutty, was brimming over with the discovery that the human enterprise, so grand and infinitely varied, had now to be managed by exceptional persons. He was an exceptional person, therefore he was an eligible candidate for power. Well, why not? Like so many Humboldts, those intellectuals who had been betrayed by the false idol of communism now found themselves gazing at the possibility of building a new Weimar, an American Weimar. If the government and its covert action arm, the CIA, was prepared to assist in this project, well, why not?
Everybody's restless, and they got no place to go. Someone's always trying to tell them something they already know. So
welcome back to the Abolitionist Hour. It's April 9th, 2022. some of you folks out there might be wondering, what does Warren Zevon have to do with the CIA and the mob? Well, you come to the right program. This is the right podcast. Warren Zevon was an understudy of Ivor Stravinsky, who was mentioned in the last part. And Warren Zevon's father was a bookie for Mickey Cohn, the L.A. mob, which you may all recall that Lana Turner's daughter stabbed one of Mickey Cohn's bodyguards. Well, legend has it that it was actually Lana Turner who stabbed him for molesting her daughter. But anyway, we're going to move on because we've got bigger fish to fry. And we're going to talk about Eric Hobsbawm and how British intelligence discovered that he had been in the Communist Party since Berlin, 1932. Was there ever a better time to sign up for a pink card than Berlin in 1932? Mike, can you think of a better time?
No, that'd be a good time if I was going to fight in the resistance. I'd certainly want to do that. I don't think the MI5 or MI6, the British intelligence services, found out about Eric until, well into the 1960s or 70s or 80s. I don't know. He was sort of a, they just sort of let him go. They don't know what to do with him, I guess. Huh?
Right. And he's joking at the end. He said, people expected me to write a book, How I Won World War II.
He was a big
everything you need to know about Eric.
Yeah, he's a big shot professor, big shot historian. I mean, worldwide. Yeah, I don't think they expected that out of him, fighting the resistance. Are you ready?
Yeah, hit it.
The structure of the Age of Revolution, of course, takes its foundation on two revolutions. On the French, which is a political one, in which the economic side is not terribly important. I mean, it is not a capitalist revolution, although Marxists in the past have tended to say, this is a bourgeoisie taking power. It says, no, it's not really the bourgeoisie taking power. It's an exponent of the professional middle classes taking power at a particular moment in French history. And similarly, the British Industrial Revolution is a bourgeois revolution where the bourgeoisie doesn't take power. It becomes powerful economically, but it does not produce a class which takes power. There's a sort of compromise in which the aristocracy says, well, if that's what you want, why not? You know, it makes the country more prosperous and bigger, you know, sort of it's fine.
The danger in a nation state which is based on ethnicity or something like that is that the inhabitants of that particular state, as it were, the state belongs to one of these groups and the others are less important, as for instance in Slovakia. Slovakia is not a state of everybody who lives in Slovakia. It belongs to the Slovaks and the others are, as it were, guests or tolerated or case might be not tolerated. And that's, once again, where the trouble starts.
In 1975, Hobsbawm followed up his Age of Revolution with the Age of Capital, continuing the story of the modern world up to 1875. He writes, in the 1860s, a new word entered the economic and political vocabulary of the world, capitalism. The global triumph of capitalism is the major theme of history in the decades after 1848. And underpinning this triumph of capitalism was the further evolution of nationalism and the formation of nation-states.
So in the Age of Capital, you have the construction of capitalism as a wider system, and that requires nationalism as well. So Bismarck is not a nationalist to begin with, but my God, when it is necessary to use nationalism to unify Germany, or at least a part of Germany, he certainly uses it. And then in the United States, you have what would be the achievement of American nationalism, namely the Civil War. It's paradoxical to talk about the Civil War being an achievement of nationalism, but the Civil War was fought for a number of reasons. Freeing the slaves is one of them. But another way of looking at the Civil War was to establish the victory of the capitalist North, and therefore to be able to construct an American nationalism without a country deeply divided between two social systems, one based on slavery, but integrated in the world economy, and one much less integrated in the world economy, but capitalist, namely the ever-growing industrial North. And 1861, the emancipation of the serfs in Russia, when the Russian authorities realized that they were defeated in Crimea because they were not advanced. And one of the ways of being advanced was to become more capitalist. And one of the ways of becoming more capitalist was to free the serfs so they could become a labor force. So you can see in Hobsbawm construct, ideologies play a role, but it's a subordinate role to other imperatives, which are not just economic in the sort of traditional Marxist way, you know, classes and so on, but actually materialistic would be a better Marxist way of defining it.
By 1876, Germany, Italy, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia had all become independent sovereign states. But there was an inbuilt tension in these developments. National identity was largely a constructed artifact, dependent on the liberal institutions of the state to impose uniformity, most notably through an official language. Those who happened not to speak the official language were required either to assimilate or to accept an inferior position. Hobsbawm writes, "The paradox of nationalism was that in forming its own nation, it automatically created a counter-nationalism. The age of liberalism did not grasp this paradox. A world of nations would, it was believed, be a liberal world, and the liberal world would consist of nations." One of the many strands Hobsbawm follows through the Age of Revolution is the emergence of nationalism and national identity. Nationalism, he writes, like so many other characteristics of the modern world, is the child of the dual revolution.
The growth of the countries, specifically Britain and France, was a growth in the power of a state. A growth in the power of a state must have some kind of ideological basis. It must unite the nation. It cannot be a class. It cannot be a region. It's got to be the whole country, which is the territorial entity upon which the state rules. And so the combination of a state must create a nation and therefore a nation state. And that is the origin of modern nationalism.
The examples of France and Britain inspired movements of young radical liberals across Europe to imagine their own national sovereignty. The young Italy of Mazzini, young Ireland, young Germany. But it was through the advance of mass education that their nationalist ideals really took hold.
The development of education is central, in Hobsbawm's view, to the construction of nationalism, because you need to figure out what is it that you're going to teach the kids in schools. And that is the business of a state. In most European countries, it is the state that controls what is being taught and the language in which it's going to be taught. So you have a solidification of a national language. And once you have the decision to have a centralized state education sector, the most important element in it is not the obvious stuff like maths, because 2 + 2 = 4 throughout the world. No, it's history. It's, well, the national literature is important, but history is the important one. Where do we come from? What is our history? And nearly all the invention of national history occur in the 19th century.
The The Age of Revolution was the era in which the construction of national identities began, a process which was central to Hobsbawm's understanding of the 19th century.
Nationalism is manufactured out of the past, and on the contrary, I mean, the past is the raw material for nationalism. And I'm bound to say that virtually everything that nationalists say about the past is wrong. As a famous 19th century French expert once put it, Ernest Renan, in his great lecture on what is nationalism, saying, getting your history wrong, or indeed even mistake forgetting history, is part of the element of becoming a nation, which is why nationalism is not compatible with the progress of history. The danger in a nation state which is based on ethnicity or something like that is that the inhabitants of that particular state, as it were, the state belongs to one of these groups and the others are less important, as for instance in Slovakia. Slovakia is not a state of everybody that lives in Slovakia. It belongs to the Slovaks, and the others are, as it were, guests or tolerated, or, in this case, might be not tolerated. And that's, once again, where the trouble starts.
In 1975, Hobsbawm followed up his Age of Revolution with the Age of Capital, continuing the story of the modern world up to 1875. He writes, in the 1860s, a new word entered the economic and political vocabulary of the world, capitalism. The global triumph of capitalism is the major theme of history in the decades up to 1848. And underpinning this triumph of capitalism was the further evolution of nationalism and the formation of nation states.
So in the Age of Capital, you have the construction of capitalism as a wider system, and that requires nationalism as well. So Bismarck is not a nationalist to begin with, but my God, when it is necessary to use nationalism to unify Germany, or at least a part of Germany, he certainly uses it. And then in the United States, you have what would be the achievement of American nationalism, namely the Civil War. It's paradoxical to talk about the Civil War being an achievement of nationalism, but the Civil War was fought for a number of reasons. Freeing the slaves is one of them. But another way of looking at the Civil War was to establish the victory of the capitalist North, and therefore to be able to construct an American nationalism without a country deeply divided between two social systems, one based on slavery, but integrated in the world economy, and one much less integrated in the world economy, but capitalist, namely the ever-growing industrial North. And 1861, the emancipation of the serfs in Russia, when the Russian authorities realized that they were defeated in Crimea because they were not advanced. And one of the ways of being advanced was to become more capitalist. And one of the ways of becoming more capitalist was to free the serfs so they could become a labor force. So you can see in Hobsbawm construct, ideologies play a role, but it's a subordinate role to other imperatives, which are not just economic in the sort of traditional Marxist way, you know, classes and so on, but actually materialistic would be a better Marxist way of defining it.
By 1876, Germany, Italy, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia had all become independent sovereign states. But there was an inbuilt tension in these developments. National identity was largely a constructed artifact, dependent on the liberal institutions of the state to impose uniformity, most notably through an official language. Those who happened not to speak the official language were required either to assimilate or to accept an inferior position. Hobsbawm writes, the paradox of nationalism was that in forming its own nation, it automatically created a counter-nationalism. The Age of Liberalism did not grasp this paradox. A world of nations would, it was believed, be a liberal world, and the liberal world would consist of Nations.
Eben dies macht die 1930er Jahre und 40er Jahre so ungeheuer interessant für den Historiker. Denn in einer Hinsicht war die Einheitsfront des liberalen Kapitalismus mit dem Kommunismus abnormal. Eine kurze Unterbrechung der bald wieder erneuerten Feindschaft. Diese Einheit wurde beiden aufgezwungen. Ohne Hitler wäre sie nicht zustande gekommen. Andererseits gehörten meiner Meinung nach sowohl der liberale Kapitalismus wie der Kommunismus zu einer historischen intellektuellen Familie. Sie sind beide Kinder der Aufklärung. Sie sprachen die gleiche Sprache. Und wenn beide überleben wollten, mussten sie nicht nur im Kampf gegen Hitler zusammenarbeiten, sondern auch voneinander.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. Deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. 66 and 7, they fought the Congo War with their fingers on their trigger.
There it was, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. And pardon all the fireworks going on if you're picking that up. But, you know, someone else that didn't work out so well with history was Pinochet. And So we got that coming up. That's 3:53, and maybe the fireworks will stop when we get through this one. Go ahead and play that, Mike. Hit it.
48 hours ago, literally 48 hours ago, on Wednesday, that General Pinochet was met at his estate by a detachment of Chilean civilian police like the FBI, accompanied by an investigating magistrate. And Pinochet was forced to sign the papers, officially putting him under house arrest for the indictment that had come earlier, 48 hours earlier. That was 96 hours ago. On Monday, General Pinochet was formally indicted on charges of the murder, kidnap, disappearance of 75 civilians in Chile. 75 out of more than 3,000, of course, that were murdered in Chile, 1,100 of whom were disappeared and whose bodies were not found. There are, coincidentally, another 225 cases pending against General Pinochet. So if he should snuggle out of this one, there's another 224 to try. But the fact of the matter is that General Pinochet has been detained. It's a little hard to follow, but he's been detained three times. He was first detained by an international arrest warrant in London in October 1998, issued by a Spanish court. We can go into that detail because it sounds kind of confusing. And he was held in British custody for 500 days. He was returned to Chile a year ago. And then 2 months ago, on the 1st of December, he was indicted by the investigating judge. That indictment was overturned by the Chilean Supreme Court on a technicality. Those technicalities were overcome in the last 2 months, and specifically in the... Now, parenthetically, I have to say that the best publication in Chile is a biweekly tabloid whose title is The Clinic. And for those of you who speak Spanish, the title of the publication is not La Clinica. It is, they actually use the English words, The Clinic. And it refers to the London Clinic in the United Kingdom, where General Pinochet was held and originally arrested in 1998. The Clinic, a couple of weeks ago, ran the most brilliant front page headline that I had seen. It was about 3 weeks ago that General Pinochet was forced to submit to mental exams, court-ordered, to see if he was fit to stand trial, because Chilean law says that if you're over 70 years of age, you have a right to be examined mentally to see if you are either, by the actual words in the code are crazy, to see whether you're loco, crazy or demented. And if you're crazy or demented, you can be excused from trial. And the Clinic, a couple of weeks ago, ran this, I should have brought it, ran this beautiful full-page a headline that said, really, it said the mental tests are superfluous because only a psychopath would throw bodies into the ocean. This came, indeed, at the same time that news was made by the Chilean Armed Forces at the beginning of this year that for the first time in history recognized that, indeed, they did throw bodies into the ocean. What is this about? And the answer is, and this is why it's so exciting to have this book out at this point now, the answer is that this is not about the trial of General Pinochet. And indeed, human rights activists in Chile recognize that there probably will not be a trial of General Pinochet because he will probably either be excused for mental reasons or he will stretch this out so long he will simply die before the trial. That is why this week it is really thrilling. You don't see it in the American press because the American press is more interested in the story of not man biting dog, but dog biting woman this week, and say that what is extraordinary about Chile is that if you are here tonight and you have enough interest in this subject to be gracious enough to come here this evening, and you already know something about Chile. You already have an association in your head. You hear the word Pinochet, and it evokes certain associations. I'm going to guess and say that those associations are dictator, human rights abuser, murderer, torturer, and all of these are true. The amazing part is that of everywhere in the world, Chile has been the place that knows the least about Chile. The things that we assume that everybody knows, millions of Chileans didn't know, because for 17 years they lived under a military dictatorship that did not permit that discussion. And then in the last 10 years of democracy, this had been pushed aside. Free trade and a privatized economy and a Thatcherite kind of celebration of the free market was pushed on the Chilean people as values more important than understanding their history. 3,000 people were killed and 1,100 were disappeared and 80 or 90,000 were tortured and a couple hundred thousand were sent into exile, but that's the price you have to pay for freedom. And that's not what you heard. You'd hear that nobody was tortured. These are stories that are made up. If people claim they were disappeared, they were guerrillas who were killed by the military because they were trying to kill police officers, etc. It was a kind of science fiction, a kind of collective denial. The wonderful news is that the events of the last 2.5 years since the arrest of Pinochet, and specifically, I'm just delighted to have been there, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, a series of events have happened in Chile that have reversed that whole course of history. What has happened in Chile now is undeniable. And even the most ardent supporters or former supporters of Pinochet or those who stuck their heads deepest into the sand now have to face that reality, right? And it is extraordinary. There might be a few Rockefeller Republicans, but I'm going to assume there aren't a lot of you. If you're not a Republican, I want you to examine the way you felt when George Bush was elected president, or when John Ashcroft was confirmed as Attorney General. Now, these men, and I need to say this coming out of Chile, these men are not fascists. They're not. And we often use that term very loosely. But I suggest that you don't, because it is to be disrespectful to those who really suffer under fascism. George Bush and John Ashcroft are conservatives. They're not fascists, and they're not Nazis, and they're not dictators. And the rule of law in the United States is flawed and unjust, but it exists. And there's a difference between a country governed by even an unjust rule of law and a government ruled by a military dictatorship, and we should never confuse the two. Having said that, look how bad you felt having these jokers elected and confirmed. And it isn't, it is a feeling, I know what it feels like, you feel a sense of frustration, of shame or embarrassment. You say, this is what my country has chosen, this is what people think, this is what we are, for example. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you can sense that, then put yourself, please, in the role of a Chilean. They knew that they were living in a authoritarian military dictatorship where abuse was the norm, where people were murdered and killed and raped and tortured. And it sounds like a cliche, but it's true, where their bodies were disappeared, where they were thrown into lime pits or thrown into the ocean, literally, where their stomachs were slid open before they were thrown out of the helicopter so that they would sink to the bottom of the ocean, where they were buried in the desert and then 10 years later had their bones dug up and were thrown into the ocean in case somebody would discover the bones. Imagine living through that for 17 years, having then a complicated political process, which we could spend hours talking about, a complicated political process then takes place where the military dictatorship retreats, where democracy is restored, where there are indeed fairly clean and orderly constitutional elections, where three succeeding civilian administrations are elected, a Congress is elected, you know, like Kansas. And the government that gets elected is, in fact, even a government of opponents of Pinochet. And yet, 7 years into that, that is to say, Pinochet leaves power in 1990, and in 1997, this man is still commander-in-chief of the army. And a year later, in 1998, when he retires as chief of the army, he assumes, under the Constitution that he had written 20 years before, he assumes legally, constitutionally, democratically, the title and position of unelected but actual senator for life. And where he not only becomes a senator for life, that is not an honorary title, he's actually in the Senate. He is actually in line to become president of the Senate. Now, imagine how you feel then. You pine for John Ashcroft. You dream of George Bush. You might even dream of James Watt at that point. Because the sense of overwhelming defeat is precisely that. It's overwhelming. If you have a brain, you go crazy. You say, well, wait a minute. We know what this, if you're aware, you say, we know who this guy is. We know what he did. The whole world knows. You may even have a relative who's disappeared or been tortured or is in exile or has been jailed. And you say, he's the senator? And there's an amnesty in place that he put before he left? And not only can he not be prosecuted, but we have to call him senator? And all of his friends and all of his cohorts and all of his accomplices and all of his supporters are also senators and deputies and the director of the Chamber of Commerce and whatever. Imagine the sort of collective psychological trauma that's inflicted upon you as a thinking individual, and then magnify that by millions, and you have a society that's in very big trouble.
La révolte kanak a duré plusieurs mois. La répression fut terrible. Et le peuple kanak, meurtri au plus profond de son âme. L'insurrection a été noyée dans le sang. Et les tribus rebelles décimées. Qui reconnaîtra les torts du gouvernement français?
The CIA wielded its hand in Chile in 1973. And later on, even while the Senate struggled to figure out exactly what that hand was doing, the ever-active CIA was pushing a strong arm in Angola. And then the CIA's favorite success story came to an end. The CIA in the 70s, on Company Business.
On Company Business has won awards and has been shown in over 35 countries around the world. Alan Frankovich, its producer and director, is with us tonight to tell us his story on Alternative Views.
Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. Our guest tonight is Alan Frankovich, who's the filmmaker who made the award-winning documentary On Company Business. That's a three-hour documentary giving the history of and exposing some of the operations of the infamous CIA. To begin, would you like to give some background about what led you to make the film in the first place, to take on the CIA?
Well, this was a film which was 5 years in production, and I started working on it in 1974, 1975. And it was apparent to me at that moment, and you have to remember that in 1975 the CIA was under investigation or on the verge of being investigated, that nobody was going to really go into the CIA and arrive at the conclusions that I thought one had to arrive at because of the collusion between the CIA and all institutions of the American establishment. But on the other hand, there a lot of people were starting to talk for the first time about things which had been done in secret over long periods of time. And I was able, therefore, to interview a whole series of people at every level of the CIA, from directors down to secretaries and accountants, and then spend a great deal of time actually researching coverage of events. Sometimes this involves CIA-created propaganda, which they inserted into the world media. And other times it involved contrasting what we were being told was happening in some country and then contrasting that with the CIA operatives telling you what they were really doing and that this was official United States policy, except it was conducted secretly so that we, the citizens of this country, would never know about it.
How did you decide that this was the time to make a film about the CIA? What did you think needed to be told to the American people about the CIA, and what was your goal in making that film?
Well, really, I think the main point, really, is that this country's had a secret foreign policy ever since the end of the Second World War. And one of the essential instruments has been the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, we've had presidents, every president since Truman has made great moral pronouncements. But the CIA has been the instrument they have used, actually, too consistently, and in every part of the world. This is interesting. It's not only in third world countries. The first CIA operations were in Europe. And you have the United States government making great moral pronouncements and statements while it's using this instrument to penetrate, infiltrate, and destroy anything which gets in the way of what they define as the interest of the United States. And if you look at the historical record and you look at the countries the film goes into, you find that, for instance, the operations they conduct, they haven't bothered asking us if we felt threatened by this, that, or the other thing. And often there's economic interest that they're defending. As a matter of fact, I would say almost always. And in some cases, the same entities that in this country don't care whether an American worker has a job or not are doing everything they can to destroy the capability of anybody in these other countries controlling their own destiny.
I think your film documents very well the infiltration and manipulation of trade unions in the third world, where they support the right-wing trade movements to try to keep these countries from forming more radical trade union movements. So you intended just simply to tell the story of the CIA from the end of World War II to the present day, to give a history of it and tell the people the truth, or what you perceived as the truth, about the CIA that the media had covered over?
Well, the thing was really to get people in the CIA who were talking for the first time to sit them down, have them tell the audience what they did, and to show consistently over a 30-year period of time that there were certain methods that were used and they had nothing to do with national security, essentially. They had a lot to do with justifying these operations, whether they're against Chile or Guatemala or Angola or in European context. They had a lot to do with intervening in the internal affairs of a whole series of countries to force them to comply with what the President of the United States wanted these countries to do. And these kinds of activities are not something which just happened in moments of crisis. They go on every day in every country of the world. And they're the official but secret foreign policy of this country. And they're done specifically on presidential orders. And what will happen in 1974 and 1975, and I believe it happened primarily because one of the political parties, in the form of Richard Nixon, started using the same agency inside this country against, not against dissidents, mind you, because I think against a major political party. And therefore, when that starts happening, you have to tell your guys, look, this far and no further. And you start investigating them, you have to make a real investigation because they know all kinds of secrets. They know where all the bodies are buried. And therefore, to rein them in, you have to investigate them. But the conclusions, I knew in 1974-75, they would never conclude that these were official government operations, that American presidents had ordered them, because the very nature of the CIA is to conduct these operations in secret, in such a way that if the CIA is caught, they take the responsibility themselves, and the President of the United States is protected.
Is that why they said that the CIA was a rogue elephant out of
control?
Exactly,
that was the conclusion. And if you look, for instance, if you look at the CIA, the assassinations of the CIA, claims they planned but never executed. You will find in several cases the Church Committee went into, the Lumumba assassination, the assassination of the Commander-in-Chief of the Chilean Army, that a few days before these people are bumped off, a cable will go out saying, don't do it, guys, and nevertheless it goes ahead. And this is, again, standard CIA operating procedure. These operations are done to preserve the cover, and so that the United States then can take a moral position while eliminating someone that they consider to be an obstacle to what they want to accomplish.
So, Alan, it seems kind of contradictory that the CIA is secret, the people are secret, and yet in your documentary you have interviews with all of these high CIA officials and you were able to talk to so many people. Why is this?
Because the CIA, they have a kind of false openness. You see, a lot of what they do, for instance, in overseas posts is they talk to the press, they manipulate the press. I would say that if you took a percentage of their operations, you would find that a great percentage-wise really have to deal with getting out their line through the media. Because if they accomplish that, in a sense, they control the way you see a situation. They control the way you think about a situation. So they have an ability, really, and they feel very much at ease with press and media. And they have, God knows, the number of books which have been written by former CIA people take a pro-CIA position. And it's only recently that there are some people like John Stoppel, Philip Agee, and a couple of other people who have really decided, well, if the pro-CIA people are writing books, why don't we write books? But we'll really go into the nature of some of these operations.
So a lot of these people who are CIA operatives that you interviewed thought they were using you and manipulating you to get their point of view across. Wasn't there a point that they found out that this guy Frankovic may be doing a hatchet job on us? And at that time, did you get any less cooperation from the CIA or worse?
I don't think they really paid much attention to what I was doing. You see, because it was, I think at the moment when they realized that this film was on a scale that they had not even imagined. Because, you see, you're dealing with 5 years of your life. You're dealing with a research effort where I researched for film, background film, in just about every film library in the world. I did a range of interviews of 50 to 60 to 80 people. On the other hand, you have to realize that, for instance, one of the persons interviewed in the film is a former president of CBS News, the founding president of CBS News in public affairs, and he says that when he became president of CBS News, they had a relationship with the CIA. He had inherited this relationship, and it involved providing cover to CIA representatives, but it also involved, and this is incredible, providing any material they had in their news library to the CIA. For instance, the CIA wanted to identify somebody in a country who was leading a demonstration. So you're dealing with a level of collusion, and you're dealing with the fact that there is a level of contact at the top level of the networks, and they're reaching 50 million people a night. So what the CIA is concerned about, they're not concerned about a little book or a little newspaper article in the Nation. They're concerned about things which really tell you the truth about what they're doing, and in this case, in CIA, on company business, it's entirely told to you by people in the agency, and then reaching a large number of people. Because the very reason they keep their operations secret is because as they try to explain them to us, they would find very little to justify them. And since this country is still a democracy, we're still allowed to vote. And God knows how long that's going to continue.
This week on Book Notes, our guest is Lerone Bennett, executive editor of Ebony Magazine. He joins us to discuss his recent book, Forced into Glory, Abraham Lincoln's White Dream.
Lerone Bennett, Jr., where did you get the title of your book, Forced into Glory?
I thought that book captured the essence of what I was trying to say in the sense that Lincoln, from my standpoint, was driven, was forced into a glory that he resisted, I think, every step of the way. Adam Grousky, one of his great critics during the Civil War here in Washington, wrote a paragraph which said that he was literally whipped into glory. I thought maybe force would be a better term for the cover. And so I settled on Forced into Glory, and it, again, captures my idea. And one of the basic ideas of the book is that there were all these extraordinary men and women, many of them white, in Washington in 1862 and 63. The American people generally do not know anything about any of them. Ashley, Lyman Trumbull, Zachariah Chandler, Salmon Chase, all these people, I say, and I try to detail it for 650 pages or so, really pushed Lincoln to glory. And the pen I put into it, Lincoln himself said, I was driven to it, literally driven to it.
Your title on the book is Abraham Lincoln's White Dream. What's that mean?
It means that, contrary to what most people think, Abraham Lincoln's deepest desire was to deport all black people and create an all-white nation. It sounds like a wild idea now, and it is a wild idea, but from about 1852 until his death, he worked feverishly to try to create deportation plans, colonization plans, to send black people either to Africa or to South Africa, South America, or to the islands of the sea. Most people, and you know the story, one of his greatest utterances, people quote it all the time, Copeland's great thing, we cannot escape history, the last best hope of the world. He said these words in a State of the Union message on December the 1st, 1862, in which he asked Congress to pass three constitutional amendments, one to buy the slaves, second to declare free all people who had actually escaped, but But the third one, his proposed 15th Amendment, asked Congress to allocate money to deport black people to another place. Now, his most, I think it's probably, other than the second inaugural, the We Cannot Escape History ending there is just torture everybody knows. Nobody talks about the fact that what he was asking Congress to do was to deport black people. It was one of his deepest ideas. And I make the point also, almost everything I say in here I take from Lincoln or from documents of the time. It was not just something he wanted to push black people out. He had an idea of this great, giant vacuum sound, black people leaving and white people from all over the world coming here and creating this all-white nation. As a matter of fact, I say, as you know, in his I Have a Dream speech at Alton, Illinois, in 1858, he called for a haven, a white haven, for free white people everywhere, the world over. Now, these are Lincoln's words. And the interesting thing about that is that he underlined these four words, free white people everywhere. He underlined them. This was his I Have a Dream speech. He was passionately committed to deporting black people and creating a white nation. Let me say in extenuation, he believed that that was the only way to solve the race problem. I found that offensive and strange, but he believed that that was the only way to solve the race problem. He said over and over again, he did not believe that black people and white people could live together in equality in the United States of America. I feel strongly about it that there ought to be a dialogue between academic people, the Lincoln establishment, as I say, and other people who have a different vision of Lincoln. To back up and to get into some, this book has been attacked pretty harshly in some quarters, praised enthusiastically in others, but I am not, up to this date in late summer, early fall, I've not seen a review anywhere which disagrees with my four or five major points. And if possible, I can make them. My first point is that the Emancipation Proclamation did not free black people. And it's doubtful if it ever freed anybody anywhere. And that Abraham Lincoln was not the great emancipator or the small emancipator or the medium-sized emancipator. That's the first point. Not only did it not free anybody, it enslaved or re-enslaved more slaves than it ever freed, because Lincoln said in the document, which most people will never read, he said that he was specifically excluding certain slaves in southern Illinois, southern Louisiana, and eastern Virginia, and elsewhere. But these were the two main categories. Now, why did he exclude these slaves in Louisiana? Because they were the only slaves he could have freed on January the 1st, 1863. The Union controlled southern Louisiana and New Orleans. The Union controlled eastern Virginia. Now, on January the 1st, he could have freed these slaves. All he had to do was just not specifically exclude them. Instead of freeing them, Abraham Lincoln, unfortunately, on January the 1st, said, I'm not talking about you. This document, you are the same as you were, as though this document never existed. So we have about 100,000 slaves in southern Illinois, southern Louisiana, sorry about that, and 80,000 or so in eastern Virginia. Having some 275,000 slaves in Tennessee who were not touched by it. All across the South, I give an estimate of approximately 500,000 slaves who were re-enslaved or kept in slavery by the Emancipation Proclamation. I want to come back to that. And as I make my second point, and I want to tell you what the critics say in response to this, is the second point is that Abraham Lincoln was a racist. I don't have any joy in making that, but I think truth is important. Who used the N-word habitually, who loved darky jokes and blackface shows, who said in Illinois and elsewhere that he was opposed to black people voting, sitting on juries, intermarrying with white people, and holding office. Two, Lincoln was a racist. Three, Abraham Lincoln wanted to deport black people and create an all-white nation. That's three. Four, Abraham Lincoln was, and this is the controversial point, maybe there were not five, four, that Abraham Lincoln was, contrary to what all the historians say, an equivocating, vacillating leader who prolonged the war, delayed emancipation, and increased the number of casualties. Now, there's no agreement on that. But the other three points, four points, all my critics agree on. What they say, and I'll be very brief about this, they say, Lerone Bennett said that the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free black people. And he's a terrible man for disturbing the peace of the Republic. That's the first sentence. The second sentence, of course the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free black people. The 13th Amendment, everybody knows that, freed black people. They agree with my first point. The second point, they say Lerone Bennett, this is a review, says that Abraham Lincoln was a racist. And he's a terrible man for saying that. Of course he was a racist. Second sentence. All white people in the 19th century were racist. I disagree with that, and I defend white people in the 19th century. I think it's absurd to say that everybody in the 19th century was a racist, but that's their defense. My point is, they agree with my second point. They say, of course he was a racist. The third point, again, is Lerone Bennett says that Abraham Lincoln wanted to deport black people and create a white nation. Say, of course he wanted to deport black people, not because he disliked them, but because he loved them so much. And he didn't think they'd ever be treated right in America. My point is, in late summer, early fall, is that all of the critics I've seen agree with my basic points. I don't know a reputable historian with a library card anywhere who maintains that the Emancipation Proclamation freed black people. I don't believe one exists anywhere. And yet, people are screaming and hollering, why did you say this? It's the truth.
À partir d'aujourd'hui, vous vous placerez par ordre alphabétique. Quelles sont celles dont le prénom commence par A? Oui?
Amélie, mademoiselle.
Alors venez ici, Amélie. B?
Hello, welcome to the Black Autonomy Podcast. My name is Jonina Irvin. As a follow-up to our last episode on Vote for Me and I'll Set You Free, the Futility of U.S. Elections, today we're going to be dealing with the topic of dual power. In other words, if we have futility in the U.S. elections in this country and the need for direct democracy, how do we begin to achieve that? That's what we'll be discussing in this episode. With me to discuss that is Lorenzo Comboa Irvin. Lorenzo and I both are co-founders of the Black Autonomy Federation. This podcast is produced by the Black Autonomy Federation. And Lorenzo is also one of the founders of the original Black Anarchist Movement in the United States. So Lorenzo, looking back and moving forward, we want to talk about how we begin to create dual power. We said that the U.S. electoral system in this country has failed people, poor and working class people. So how do we begin to move forward to establish dual power, and what is dual power?
Well, first of all, we need to understand some things that when we talked about the criticism of the United States government and its electoral process, because that's what we're talking about, we have to also be talking about alternatives to it, but not just alternatives to the electoral portion of the government. We have to talk about a program to totally replace the government and the capitalist system, ultimately. That's what we have to be talking about. And it has to be a transitional program. So we're not just saying, here's a documentary or so forth, declaration or so forth, method of explaining it. We need a method. We need a movement. As we were talking about last time, the movement itself We were talking about it in terms of the electoral system. This time we're going to talk about it in terms of building an alternative infrastructure on the one hand, and on the other hand, going past the stages of what we're calling insurrectionary politics. When I say insurrectionary, I'm not just talking about armed self-defense or armed struggle, but talking about a means of opposition to the government. We want to go past the stage of just legal or so-called illegal protests to be able to then talk about transforming the economy and the political system and creating something totally new. But before we can get to that, we need to understand that this is all a transitional phase. We have to, first of all, realize that we have to start in our local communities. Once again, you know, we have to start on the lowest level or lowest form of organization and build from there. Somebody said, well, how do you do this and how do you do that? Well, you do it by organizing on the lowest level. We create revolution on the lowest level. So if we just said to ourselves, how would we be able to build a revolutionary movement in this country? One is to be able to challenge the state at every turn. And certainly when we were talking about direct democracy, that would be a method of challenging the electoral system on the one hand, and on the other hand, to bring about a new consciousness among masses of people that this thing is a fraud. It has never been created. It was never created to support the rights of black people and poor people, in fact, in this country, since the first people who were able to vote were whites that owned land. That was the only way you could get a chance to vote. And then, of course, if you were a slave or if you were a native, you still had no right to vote at all, and you had no other rights as a citizen or any of that. So it was only up to 1964 that blacks got the right to vote. We talked about that. So now we talk about how to implement programs that will allow us to create this new society, because just not voting or creating a protest movement alone, it'll change society, but it won't change society in the sense of a revolutionary change, which is a total transformation. So we talk about dual power. We'll talk about it, one, in the sense that most activists understand it in terms of a cultural and political movement, which can challenge the state, which can, over the course of time, build up the mass movement itself into where it can derail the government. But it's a transitional program. It's not designed to overthrow the state in its own self. It's not a liberatory program in and of itself. So dual power, there are as many definitions as there are for direct democracy. Some people think direct democracy means voting by a mass national referendum process. And some people think it means removing politicians locally and so forth and so on, but leaving the system itself intact. So there's all kinds of ideas about direct democracy, and the same can be said for dual power. But what we're talking about is the kind of situation where, as an oppressed people, we have to create a political alternative to allow us to go to the stage past political power under this system. We're not seeking to just create autonomy on a scale where we preserve the rights of the ruling class. And many people begin these programs and projects, and they call them revolutionary or whatever they call them, without having an understanding of that. Whatever you do has to be in opposition to those in power, and it has to empower those who are on the bottom. So that's the first simple thing to understand. But also, it's a form of radical oppositional movement that creates alternative, autonomous institutions, economic, social, and political. And it's a way to take the condition of oppressed people, poor people, that the government does not serve and that the government doesn't intend to serve, and you create an alternative public sector that can feed people, give them housing, jobs, decent health care, and so forth. You can bring them into a new form of the economy and a new form of political structure. Some people in some countries have created and called it a solidarity economy. Well, we may be talking about that, but we may be going further than that and have the ability to do that based on our specific situation in the United States. And we need to understand that one of the first examples of this that we know of was the Black Panther Party's survival programs.
Well, dual power is certainly what we are seeking to achieve, but we're not under any illusions that it's going to be overnight and it's going to happen quickly, because these movements will have to be built. People will have to build them on the local level, on the grassroots, from the bottom up. But this is going to be key to bringing about the total transformation that we need to have in the United States, with a system that has certainly failed all working class, poor, low-income people, and in particular, black people and people of color, because of the history of institutional racism in this country. So that's our discussion for this episode of the Black Autonomy Podcast. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you on our next episode. Thank you. Hello, welcome to the Black Autonomy Podcast. My name is Jonina Irvin. As a follow-up to our last episode on Vote for Me and I'll Set You Free, the Futility of U.S. Elections, today we're going to be dealing with the topic of dual power. In other words, if we have futility in the U.S. elections in this country and the need for direct democracy, how do we begin to achieve that? That's what we'll be discussing in this episode. With me to discuss that is Lorenzo Comboa Irvin. Lorenzo and I both are co-founders of the Black Autonomy Federation. This podcast is produced by the Black Autonomy Federation. And Lorenzo is also one of the founders of the original Black Anarchist Movement in the United States.
And we have an expert, fortunately, with us who's able to talk about this at length.
Well, I was in the Black Panther Party for many years and had a chance to, you know, see these survival programs in operation. This, as Lorenzo was saying, the Black Panther Party survival programs were, in fact, an example of an effort, a successful effort, while it lasted, to create dual power in the United States. The Black Panther Party had a school, Oakland Community School. It had a free food program. One of its most respected survival programs was a free breakfast for children, which was overall a response to hunger and poverty in the country, particularly among poor, black, low-income people. We had free medical clinics in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We had a free ambulance program, free pest control, free shoes. We had a free busing to prisons program, a legal aid program to help people get attorneys who needed them. And we also had a program that was called the SAFE program, Seniors Against a Fearful Environment, in which we provided free transportation and an escort service when senior citizens needed to get out and take care of their errands, their business. They were often being attacked. So this was a form of protection for them. The first Black Panther Party survival program was actually created in 1968, the breakfast program. And some people criticized the Black Panther Party survival programs, saying that they were reformist programs. And Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, said, these are not reform programs. They're actually revolutionary community programs. A revolutionary program is one step forward by revolutionaries, by those who want to change the system to a better system. A reform program is set up by the existing exploitative system and appeasing handouts to fool the people and keep them quiet. That's what Bobby Seale said about the survival programs.
Groceries, way over 6,000 bags of groceries being given away free. Tomorrow night, the Black Panther Party has organized the whole conference, and tomorrow night at the Oakland Auditorium, that's Wednesday tomorrow night at 6 p.m., we expect way over 6,000 people to come down and get their free bags of groceries and also to register to vote. To unify the vote around the very concrete program so that in the future, the black community and other poor oppressed people in any kind of vote will be unified around concrete survival programs like this, so the people won't be axed by the politicians to endorse them, but the politicians will have to endorse people's community survival program, such as free food, because people got to eat every day.
This is a new approach for the Black Panther Party, isn't it?
It's not, per se, a new approach. It's some new kind of work. It's all related to our original vision, though, of the Black Panther Party over 6 years ago. And the Black Panther Party organizing this kind of operation really shows that we're implementing the original vision of the Black Panther Party.
The other Black Panther Party co-founder, Huey P. Newton, said we call these programs survival pending revolution. They were designed to help the people survive until their consciousness is raised, which is only the first step in the revolution to produce a new America. In themselves, they do not change social conditions, but they are life-saving vehicles until conditions change. And that's what Huey Newton said about the survival programs.
My name is Kalita Smith. I'm 8.5 years old. I live in Oakland, California.
Oh, we can do it too. Put your hand,
I go to school at the Oakland Community Learning Center. My school was started by the Black Panther Party.
And when you look at the free breakfast program for children, in which free hot breakfast was served to school children during the regular school year, this was a program that the Black Panther Party created for a number of reasons. We saw on a practical level that kids were not able to go to school and learn anything if they were hungry. That's impossible. No one can, in fact, do that.
Everything was a problem. For example, they used to serve cookies and I think graham crackers and milk in the morning to children in primary school who had the money to pay for it. And if you didn't have the money to pay for it, you had to put your head on the desk until the other kids finished eating. I always thought that was very bad, but at the Oakland Community School, everybody eats.
My school serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because sometimes your mother or father or whoever you're living with probably don't have enough food for you. Some of the people who serve food are teachers.
And we also saw that this was a way, as we put it, to raise the consciousness of the people about hunger and poverty in the United States. And ultimately, this breakfast program forced the federal government to expand their free lunch program to a bigger breakfast program, because they certainly did not want the Black Panther Party to get credit for feeding hungry kids, which we did. A lot of people supported this program strongly. So this was a program that really educated people about hunger and poverty in the United States. And, you know, it got the attention of the FBI as part of their counterintelligence program, in which they said that the breakfast program was, in fact, what they called the single most dangerous program of the Black Panther Party. It was feeding hungry kids, but it was dangerous, according to them, because it was feeding people. Because when you feed people, that's a basic human need. And then another organization that for a while dealt with the whole concept of dual power was an organization that started around the time the Black Panther Party did, was called the National Welfare Rights Organization. And what they did was they sought to assist people who were on public assistance between the time of 1966, 1975. And most of these people at that time were low-income women of color. And so the National Welfare Rights Organization educated welfare recipients about their rights, told them what they were entitled to, told them how to get it, and they also exposed the racist treatment of Black women within the public assistance program. Black women got one thing, not very much. White women got other things. So these are just two examples in fairly recent American history of attempts and successful attempts for as long as they lasted to create dual power in the United States. So those are things we can look to as lessons in the fact that this can be done. Of course, our situation right now, the social and political economic crisis we are in right now, is far worse now than it was back in the late 60s and early 70s when the Black Panther Party was at its height and the National Welfare Rights Movement. Well, dual power is certainly what we are seeking to achieve, but we're not under any illusions that it's going to be overnight and it's going to happen quickly. because these movements will have to be built. People will have to build them on the local level, from the grassroots, from the bottom up. But this is going to be key to bringing about the total transformation that we need to have in the United States, with a system that has certainly failed all working class, poor, low income people, and in particular, black people and people of color, because of the history of institutional racism in this country. So that's our discussion for this episode of the Black Autonomy Podcast. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you on our next episode. Thank you.
Is there a myth in heaven? Mama, that's why you really want to go. Is there a myth in heaven? Mama, up there for those streets paved with gold. Trouble runs through my veins. 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 Trouble from heaven runs through my veins. The food stamps by beer in heaven, Mama. But tell me that's why Daddy got baptized. Food stamps by beers in heaven, Mama. Or does Jesus turn water into wine? Trouble runs through my veins. 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 Trouble heaven runs through my veins. Will you ever grow old in heaven, Mama? Tell me from that oxycontin cold. Will you ever grow old in heaven, Mama? Up there does the Lamb God shoot dope. Trouble runs through my veins. 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 Trouble from heaven runs through my veins. Trouble 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 from heaven runs through my veins.
The Pledge of Allegiance by Utah Phillips. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the multinational corporations and to the prophet for which they stand, one interlocking directorate, under no government, indivisible, with monopoly and cheap labor for all.
We march in formation, lockstep, in cadence, so that their bodies don't betray their fear by jerky, hesitant motions. Head straight, on order, by order, so that the folder cannot confirm under certain eyes. They make noises. Hut two, to think. Hut two, and whatever they are told, instead of possible death, and they think of dying anyway, even though they are used to thinking whatever they are told, and they think they should be honored for this, and they shall be increasingly with grenades, lockstep. Kwasi Balagoon, December 22nd, 1946, December 13th, 1986. Black Panther, member of the BLA, New African Anarchist.